ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिदां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीं अम्बत्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम्। We meditate on the Bhagavad Gita that gave enlightenment to Arjuna, the nectar of immortality poured forth in 18 chapters by the Lord Himself in the Mahabharata. O Mother Bhagavad Gita, I bow down before you, the destroyer of the endless cycles of miseries of human life. यं ब्रह्मा वरुणेन्द्ररुद्रमरुदस्तुन्यन्ति दिव्यैस्तवैः वेदैः साङ्गपदक्रमोपनिषदैः गायन्ति यं सामगाः ध्यानावस्थिततद्गतेन मनसा पश्यन्ति यं योगिनो यस्यान्तं न विदुःसुरासुरगणाः देवाय तस्मै नमः। ऐ बो डौन् to the Lord, the Divine Reality, praised in the song Bhagavad Gita, who has revealed the ancient Vedic scriptures to the sages and yogis in the depths of their meditation. We are continuing the discussion of the text. As I mentioned in the previous session, Gita is in the form of a dialogue between two men of action, Arjuna and Lord Krishna, who is considered to be an incarnation of God in the Vedantic tradition. So Arjuna was facing a big dilemma in his life. That kind of problems frequently many of us have to face. When a situation arises, when there's a challenge as to how to do our normal work, how to perform our duties and responsibilities. If the work or the duty is not apparently very pleasant, then we may have a tendency to avoid it, giving some false justification for not doing it. And if there is something which is not really our duty, we may have a tendency to do it, though it may not be our responsibility to do it, because it is pleasant apparently. We may be prompted to do this. So this kind of internal conflict many of us face at the physical level, at the psychological level, how to do certain things, in which direction to turn, to the left or to the right, to do this way or that way, or whether I should do this or not. So in answer to this, Lord Krishna gives a series of instructions which are outlined in these 18 chapters. So one important point the teacher emphasizes is sudharma. That I shall try to explain this. This is one of the central topics of this text. Now, what is Sodharma? The Sanskrit etymological definition is Sobhava Niyatam Karmai Sodharma. Sobhava is our natural characteristics, our fitness, our tendencies, and also the circumstances that make a certain work our moral responsibility. A doctor, he has to do his best as a professional medical practitioner. A teacher has to teach. A student has to study, and so on. So there are certain activities and duties and responsibilities which are related to the circumstances in which we may find ourselves. And also the compulsions of social obligations, family obligations, and also the availability of opportunities. So all these together create a situation where we feel, well, this is something that we have to do. Now there is one interesting aspect that Gita brings out. All of us more or less know what is our real duty and responsibility. So that itself is a proof that there is the divine reality, you may call God, present in all of us. All of us know. Every professional lawyer will know he has what duty he has to perform. Every teacher knows what is his duty. Every student also knows. So there is an inherent natural awareness of what our duty is. By force of circumstances, by the force of obligations, demands and needs to fulfill certain requirements. That we know. But we may not feel like doing it. So then we may feel a kind of internal conflict. This internal conflict may be due to a desire to do something that is not our duty, but apparently more pleasant. So Gita has got a very strong statement. Swadharme nidhanam sreya paradharmo bhayavaha. The meaning is this. One's prosperity, success, happiness and progress is in the matter of doing one's own appointed duties and responsibilities. If he or she takes up another person's duties and responsibilities because it appears to be more pleasant or appears to produce a more happy external result, so we may be tempted to do certain things which we know very well not to be our duty. So Gita says, one's achievement, prosperity, success and contentment is in doing one's own duties. So that's an important subject in this text. Now, in answer to Arjuna's complaints, his long lamentation, description of his internal conflicts, Lord Krishna begins his answer. He begins his response in the 11th verse of the second chapter. So those of you who have got the text, you can see the 11th verse of the second chapter. That's where Lord Krishna begins his real response. I mean, he of course speaks earlier, Klaibhyam Masmagama Parthana Yatto Yubavadyade Kshudram Hredaurbalyam Tektu Artishta Varandava. In fact, Lord Krishna in the second chapter, the beginning of the text, first verse, says he actually condemns Arjuna's imbecility, his hypocrisy. In fact, there is an element of hypocrisy in Arjuna's words that will come out. Lord Krishna himself brings out that aspect. So the teacher uses a strong language to point out some of the inherent and obvious errors. Errors which Arjuna is apparently aware of. But he wants to make us believe that he is not aware of them. So very often mind plays a nasty trick. And an expert teacher will be able to point his finger straight at that problem. And that's how the teacher succeeds in catching the attention of the student, because the student then understands, well, the teacher really understands his problem. So the teacher, Lord Krishna, at first scolds Arjuna using strong language. But then, after that, in the 11th verse, he begins a long discourse on the nature of human life, what we actually are. Why should he take up the subject of metaphysics and ethics in answer to Arjuna's lamentations? Because Lord Krishna found out that Arjuna has got certain strong misunderstandings as to what is duty and what is not duty, what is proper and what is not proper, and what actually constitutes the reality of human life or not. And Arjuna has a strong misunderstanding as to what he actually is. He thinks he is the physical body, the psychophysical mechanism. That's how he looks upon himself. That's how he looks upon others. So Lord Krishna wants to clear all these doubts. So the 11th verse is, Ashochyan anyashojastvam prajnavadamcha bhashase gadasun agadasumcha na anushochanti panditaha. This is the verse. So the Lord says, you talk as if you are a wise person. Prajnavadan, prajnavadam, buddhimadam, vadan. Means the words that normally wise men speak. So if you look at Arjuna's words that he uttered in the first chapter, you find Arjuna was facing an internal conflict. But he's not actually openly admitting that. He gives some false justifications for not doing his duty, and he is giving some false justifications for doing duty of somebody else. I shall give an example. Well, that will drive home the idea. You know, the dialogue takes place in a battlefield. The story has nothing at all to do with battle or war. That should be understood very clearly. The battlefield is our own heart, our own mind. It's kind of inner warfare. Now, who faces this inner warfare? As I mentioned earlier, people who are refined, cultured, and evolved to some extent, says who has a sense of right and wrong. I should do what is appropriate. I should avoid doing what is inappropriate. That kind of sense of right and wrong, sense of morality and ethics, and inner refinement and culture, such people alone face inner conflicts. Others will not face. Those who are highly evolved, a Buddha will have no problem. And a moron, a person is almost... there are many people who are physically, they look like human beings. The mind is totally unevolved. See, cutthroat, hardened criminals who are bent upon doing the wrong things. Such people will have no inner conflict. Arjuna was actually a good man. He wanted to do what is appropriate. And he was a very intelligent person. He was an active person. So Arjuna had this conflict. So he thought, well, by not doing his duty of, well, doing the duty to soldier, whose duty was to work for dharma, work for appropriate, to protect poor people, women folk, unprotected people. That was his duty. So he wanted to run away from it. He heard that a Buddha could become a monk, a Christ can become a monk, a Shankaracharya could become a monk. Why not I also become a monk? That is his problem. So, now, if you really look at Arjuna's words, he speaks like a Jesus Christ, a Buddha. Nakamshe vijayam krishna nacha rajyam sukhani cha kinno rajyena govinda ki bhogai jivitenava. Well, put in a different language. Suppose a doctor or an engineer constructing a building, and he has to be very careful The building should not collapse. Oh, what's the use of building this so carefully? Anyway, it is everything is going to die, destroyed. The building is not going to last for 1 billion years. So why bother all this? A doctor, anyway, he will die after 100 years. Even if he gives the best medicine, best treatment, he's going to die maybe after 100 years. So don't worry too much about this treatment. Now, apparently he's speaking mighty big metaphysics. But he's practicing paradharma. He's speaking the language of great renunciation. It is okay for a Buddha, not for Arjuna. So Lord Krishna says, see, you know, prajñāvatāṁ buddhimatāṁ vādhāṁ. Sri Shankaracharya says, he's speaking the words of a prajñāvatā, means highly enlightened, educated people, great sages, saints, and those men of renunciation, those who are sitting in a cave meditating on God. That's the language that Arjuna speaks. That's totally wrong. So Lord Krishna says, you're speaking like a wise man, which you are really not. And then he says, what are you worried about? You're worried about you have to fight with people. You know they are not certainly not the right kind of people. So it's not proper for me to do my duty as a soldier. Then Lord Krishna, gadasu na gadasumsa na anushochanti panditaka. Really wise men, once they're convinced what their duty is, they don't worry too much about these things. They go on doing their duty. It's called swadharma. So this swadharma is a very important theme in the Bhagavad Gita. If you do your swadharma, then on the one hand, it will be good for your family, for the society, for the nation. At the same time, it will be good for your mind also. When we do something which we consider to be our duty, we feel a kind of inner joy, inner contentment. It is our own private spiritual experience of bliss. So whatever we consider to be our real duty, when we do it, it gives us a kind of inner contentment. So these are the criteria by which we can really understand what swadharma is. On the one hand, you meditate, you pray, when you become refined, you will have an inherent, an instinctive understanding of what our swadharma, what our own appointed duty and responsibility is. And you will have no doubt about it. In case you have any doubt, then if you read the scriptures, then you know that what is conducive for the welfare of others and also for the welfare of our own life, that is swadharma. That you should do, and you should not have any doubt about it. After making this statement, Lord Krishna in the 12th verse makes a very profound metaphysical statement. Natvevaham jadunasam natum neme janathipaha nachaivana bhavishyama sarve vayamataparam. The meaning is this. Now he says, what's our true nature? If we look upon ourselves as this physical body, then we have been existing for the last 50 years, 60 years, or 70 years. That's our life. But Vedanta tells you it is not the physical body alone that matters. This physical, psychophysical mechanism belongs to time. There is something else within all of us that is beyond time. So the timeless, eternal, immortal dimension of our true life and personality, our true being, is expounded in the 12th verse. So literally, you know what it means. The meaning is this. There was no time when you did not exist, when I did not exist, when these people did not exist. And there will be no time when you, me and these people around whom you meet in this field will not exist. Means, as bodies, we come and go. As Atman, we remain the same. That means there is something in all of us that belongs to time, that is this body. And that is something made of five elements. They exist for some time, they disappear after some time. Vedanta tells you that there are three levels of reality. One, the highest, the absolute reality, which is eternal, immortal, and infinite. And that's beyond time. And that reality is unborn and it is also deathless. It is called Ajam because it is not born. It is Avayam, it doesn't undergo any decay. It is Amrutam, it is immortal. That is our true dimension. This mind, it comes and goes. Mind also changes. Body also changes. Every day, every year, body gets older and it goes one step nearer to destruction. But death in Vedanta is only a semicolon, not a full stop. So one important aspect of Vedanta philosophy to keep in mind is, one is reincarnation, the other is love karma. These two ideas should be kept in mind when we read these verses. So as physical bodies, as psychophysical mechanisms, we come and go. When we are born, we get a new body, but we bring with us a bundle, and that bundle is full of samskaras, tendencies, impressions, gathered over hundreds of life cycles. That's why when you happen to read a book, or when you listen to a great idea, you feel that this is really something that seems to make sense. People who have never read Vedanta earlier, who have never read these things, when they listen to great spiritual ideas, they feel a kind of an unconscious feeling of familiarity, as if it's perfectly okay. When you feel at home with a new idea, it means this isn't the first time you are coming in contact with that idea. That's because when we are born with a mental system. It is called Antakarana in Vedanta, or internal organs. Its main component is samskara. And samskaras are tendencies, attitudes, feelings, emotions. The way we respond to people, the way we respond to ideas, these tendencies constitute a bundle with which we are born. And when we physically disappear after 100 years of happy life in this world, we take back with us something which doesn't get destroyed in the crematorium. And it continues its journey, is born again in another life. In the science of Vedic astrology, this is given a very interesting interpretation which may appear to make sense. See, suppose parents, husband and wife, are praying to God. They live pure life, unselfish life. A lot of good actions, they become totally unselfish. They live pure life, pure thoughts. Then there will be individual souls, these samskaras and tendencies, individual souls looking for a correct, a good parentage, a family into which they want to be born. So you find a kind of concordance, a mutual match. That's why in ancient Veda Hindu tradition, mothers who are expecting children used to spend long time in prayers, meditation, and spiritual practices. This you find in many other traditions also. Because individual jivas who have left their physical body in previous life, but a lot of good samskaras, good tendencies, are seeking appropriate homes and parents to take the next birth, so that they can continue their spiritual journey. So, and this continues, so long as we do not realize our true nature, that we are Atman, till that point of evolution, we continue traveling from life to life, being born, living for a long time, doing a lot of good actions and also maybe a few bad actions, accumulating new tendencies and impressions, samskaras we call them, and born again, this journey continues. Once we realize through spiritual practices our eternal immortal nature, that is our timeless dimension, at that point we become one with this all-pervading spiritual reality. This is the Vedantic interpretation. Now, Lord Krishna says, Natvevaham jadunasam natum neme janathipaha. So, you and me and these people whom you meet in this battlefield, they were always here. Bodies come and go, but Atman remains. So, once you understand you are this Atman, then you realize your timeless dimension. That means there was no time when you and me and they and these people around did not exist. And there will be no time when they will not exist. As Atman, they will be always there. As physical bodies, they naturally come and go. Actually, there is not only a great metaphysics, but also there is an eternal hope. Vedanta tells you, whatever little actions we do in this life create a kind of spiritual deposit that is put in our bank. When we are born again, we are born with a checkbook and fountain pen. So in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asked a very interesting question to Krishna. The question is very simple, which every spiritual seeker may be prompted to ask. Suppose we pray and meditate, we do a lot of good things, we get enough time, we spend some money for helping others, charitable work, and did our duty to parents, children, grandchildren, and so on. But still, we feel that we had not made enough progress. What happens then? Now, this question has a relevance only if you believe that you have only one life. But you don't have just one life. So Arjuna's question is, Ayadi Sriddhayo Pedo Yoga Chalidamatmanaha. That means, Ayadi Sriddhayo Pedo Yoga Chalidamanasaka. I mean, somebody who has done a lot of spiritual practices, but still Ayati, not fully succeeded in restraining the senses. So there's a deviation, or the person may die before he reaches the highest spiritual fulfillment. So Ayadi Sriddhayo Pedo Yoga Chalidamanasaha Aprapa Yoga Samsiddhim Kam Gatim Krishna Gacchati. Suppose such a person dies, then what will be the condition of a person? In answer to this, Lord Krishna says, Purvabhyasena Tenaiva Hridehi Avashopisaha Jignasi Rabi Yogasi Shabda Brahmadi Vartati. So what happens, you know, when you are born again, you are born with a set of tendencies and impressions. And these impressions are deposited in your mental system by your actions. So you feel a natural, a strange inclination to do good actions, to speak, to do good things, to think good thoughts. It could be the other way also. All because of Purvabhyasa means earlier practices done not in previous life, maybe several life cycles earlier. So all these good tendencies you will be born with as a burden. And then, if you have done good actions in the past, you will be helpless because you will be forced to continue doing good actions in this life. How this happens? In the sixth chapter, there is another verse. Tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade parudekhikam yatadecha tadobhuya samsiddho kurunantana. In our mental system, buddhisam, buddh means mental system here, it means. These tendencies are there. The good tendencies. And when you are born again, you know, if you are walking in front of a holy, a place where good actions, good thoughts, good ideas are being are vibrating, let us say. When we happen to go there, our mind connects with that place. Our mind may connect with such persons from whom good these good tendencies, good actions come. It could happen any religious tradition. So, that's why Lord Krishna says, from previous life cycles, we bring with us this bundle of good samskaras, good impressions. So no action is wasted. You are never late. So any day, any moment, anyone can start a new life. But you are never late. That's the idea behind. So Lord Krishna says here, there was no time when you, me and these people did not exist. Because we are immortal. So, this chapter is called Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya does not refer to the metaphysical school of Sankhya philosophy. Sankhya here means the path of jnana, the path of wisdom. That's what the meaning here. Now, in the next verse, the Lord Krishna continues, Dekhi nosmi yadha dekhi kaumaram yavanam jara tadha dehantar praptihi dhiras tatrana mukhyati. Now, this is a very great philosophy that we can hold in our right hand when we are living in this world. If you have this idea in the manual, then you have no reason to worry about. Dekhi nosmi yadha dekhi kaumaram yavanam jara. In this body, all these changes happened. When you are born, you are a baby. Then you become a boy or girl. Then you become a youth, middle age, old age. Then gradually you approach death and born again. So these changes happened at the physical level. And this is part of the physical mechanism. Once you get an idea of this timeless, eternal, trans-empirical dimension of your personality, then dhiraha namuhyadi. Dhira means, dhi in Sanskrit means refined wisdom, higher wisdom, knowledge, information, plus a higher instinctive wisdom that helps us to make proper use of what we know. That higher mental skill can be called dhihi or wisdom. Wisdom is not the fruit of education. Frequently, education neutralizes whatever wisdom we already are born with frequently. That happens. Education frequently has a negative effect on wisdom. There are many people who didn't have very high education. They were men of wisdom, men and women of wisdom. So this higher skill, discerning wisdom, discerning mind, a natural instinctive or intuitive understanding of what is proper and what is not proper, that special intellectual mental skill is called thi. Literal meaning could be is a brave person. A person who becomes brave as a result of this higher spiritual wisdom. So men or women of this higher wisdom never worries about anything because the body is weak. Something happens to the body. He may go to hospital, he must take care of the body. Body has a meaning and relevance, no doubt. Vedanta or Hinduism never ask you to neglect this body. That is a totally wrong, absolutely unacceptable misinterpretation of the essence of Vedanta. There are people who try to interpret Hinduism and Vedanta as a kind of life-negating, world-negating, over asceticism. Nothing is farther from truth. It's not. In fact, I can quote in this context, you know, there's a great poet in India. He lived in the 2nd century AD. His name was Kalidasa. Let's say India's Shakespeare, so to speak. He wrote poems, he wrote plays, and his poetical works and dramas were translated into European languages from early 18th century onwards. Now, his name was Kalidasa. So there is an interesting discussion in one of his books. It's called, you know, Kumara Sambhava. So the discussion, the statement is this. അപിക്രിയാർത്ഥം സുലഭം സമീർക്കുശം ജലാനിവിസ്നാനം വിധിക്ഷമാണിതേ അപി സ്വശക്തിയ തപസി പ്രവർത്തസേ ശരീരമാദ്യം ഖലു ധർമ്മസാധനം. ഐ ആം ഗോയിങ് ടു ടേക്ക് അപ്പ് ഓൺലി ദി ഹാഫ് ഓഫ് ദി സെക്കൻഡ് ലൈൻ. ദാറ്റ്സ് വെരി ക്രൂഷ്യൽ ഹിയർ. ശരീരമാദ്യം ഖലു ധർമ്മസാധനം, ദിസ് എ മീനിങ്. ദിസ് എ യു ഹേർഡ് ഓഫ് ആയുർവേദ, ദിസ് ഈസ് ബിക്കമിംഗ് പോപ്പുലർ ഇൻ ദി ബേരിയ. ദിസ് ദ മോട്ടോ ഓഫ് ആയുർവേദ, സോ ടു സ്പീക്ക്. ദെൻ യു വിൽ അണ്ടർസ്റ്റാൻഡ്. ശരീരമാദ്യം ഖലു ധർമ്മസാധനം, ദ സ്ലോഗൻ ഓഫ് ആയുർവേദിക് ഫിസിഷ്യൻസ്. വാട്ട് ഇറ്റ് മീൻസ്, ആദ്യം മീൻസ് ഇമ്പോർട്ടൻറ്റ്, സാധനം മീൻസ് ഇൻസ്ട്രുമെൻറ്റ്, ശരീരം മീൻസ് ബോഡി. ബോഡി ഇസ് ദ മോസ്റ്റ് ഇമ്പോർട്ടൻറ്റ് ഇൻസ്ട്രുമെൻറ്റ് ഫോർ ലൈഫ്. ദിസ് ഈസ് ദി സ്റ്റേറ്റ്മെൻറ്റ് ഇൻ ദി കുമാര സംഭവ. ആൻഡ് ഇറ്റ് കംസ് ഫ്രം ശിവ, വൺ ഓഫ് ദി ഡീറ്റീസ് ഇൻ ഹിന്ദു ട്രഡീഷൻ. വാട്ട് സേസ് ദിസ് ബോഡി ഈസ് വെരി ഇമ്പോർട്ടൻറ്റ്, വെരി റെലവൻറ്റ്, very much necessary, very useful, but we should know that it is not going to be immortal. There is, life has got much higher meaning than polishing this body or keeping this body intact as if it is going to last for long. Every person who has ever who reads newspapers obituary columns every day, obituary columns, or goes to crematorium at least once in his life, knows that it's not going to happen to any of us. But still, somewhere in a distant, hidden corner of our mind, we have this wrong notion, where I'm going to live for long, or live eternally. In fact, this is, and in Mahabharata, there's a great wise man, he's called Yudhishthira. He was an elder brother of Arjuna, the student in the Gita. He says, Ahanni ahanni bhudani, every day, every minute, somebody is getting visa and passport to the abode of death. Yama is the king of death, mythological figure. So every day, every minute, somebody is getting visa and passport for going to Yama's palace. Yama is the lord of death. But still, seeing this happening every minute, we think we are going to live eternally. Now, this is an interesting aspect of human life. So Lord Krishna says, it's not going to happen. It doesn't mean that Vedanta is life-negating, world-negating philosophy. Not at all. This body is important. Body is necessary. And it is our duty and responsibility, it's a sacred duty to keep this body healthy, active, no doubts. For what? For achieving something beyond this body. Now, so it is a gymnasium. You don't go and live in a gymnasium. You use gymnasium for a different purpose, not to take residence in gymnasium. But gymnasium is needed to make the body healthy and strong. Like that, this body is an instrument, dharma sadhanam, for practicing and attaining dharma. Dharma means higher spiritual goal. So, dehi nosmi tha dehi, means In this body, boyhood, childhood, boyhood, youth, middle age, old age, disease, death, and again rebirth, all these are happening. And a wise person, he will take care of his body, but doesn't lose his sleep if he has got a headache or if he has got a problem. You know, everything is lost. He doesn't think that way. You can imagine Stephen Hawking, a man like him. If he was such a person, we won't be talking about him today. We won't be reading about him. So, there is a higher dimension to human life than this body. And people who understand this timeless, deathless, immortal dimension of our own personality do not worry much about anything that happens in this body. We'll take care of it, but will not worry themselves to death. That's the statement that you find in the 13th verse of the Gita. Now we will have interaction for 10 minutes. You are most welcome to ask any question from this text, from any part, not necessarily on those points that we discussed today, but we'll continue discussion again. You are most welcome to open a discussion on any related topic.
Swamiji, what's the relationship of the chakra system and the kundalini from a Vedantic point of view? Because if the body is mortal, and if in the Hindu tradition there are deities on different levels within the human body, it's not only the personal ego that has a body, but there may be a cosmological internal sphere that needs to be paid attention to.
You know, the Kundalini, you can read Kuvalayananda's famous book, you know, The Serpent Power. I think he was an American or an Englishman who became a judge and who spent his lifetime to study this tantra. He wrote a famous book, Serpent Power. It's a classical textbook available in English language on this science. So you find Kundalini is, if you look at the picture, there are six chakras. And if you look at you can see something physical there. It is only symbolic. The physical in Kundalini science is only a symbol. So when you do spiritual practice, meditation, prayer, reading scriptures, feeding your mind with spiritual food, there's a gradual evolution from Mooladhara, the lowest physical level of human consciousness, to higher level Sahasrara. So those who practice spiritual practices, it could be meditation, it could be prayer, it could be tantra practice as well. When you do that, you reach a higher dimension of your own consciousness. Well, to put it in simpler language, I can say, Ajna Chakra corresponds to a higher level of our human consciousness. Mooladhara corresponds to the lowest level. Mooladhara, Swadhisthana, Manipura, etc. Now, Ajna is a higher intellectual power. Now, I'm not talking about religion now. You can read about great scientists, great painters. Well, we're talking about Stephen Hawking just now. Certainly not a yogi or a conventional religious person, a temple goer, a church goer, not at all. Now, their consciousness level or their way of interpreting their own essential personality was not physical. If you are physical, they won't be able to live. People, Helen Keller. I'm giving examples from a most unlikely realm of examples. You know, not the traditional Vedantic circles. You can find many such great men and women who transcended their physical dimension, even their mental and intellectual dimension. They must have done it by practicing unselfishness, total freedom from selfishness, and constant contemplation and thought, focus on higher ideas will give you a higher elevation of your own consciousness. On the other hand, if a person constantly thinks only about physical things, his mind will be at a very low level. So, Kundalini, the ascent of the Kundalini is a symbolic explanation of elevation of our own consciousness. So, at the highest Sahasrara level, it is purely spiritual. It goes far beyond intellectual. So, the pictorial presentation of the Shat Chakras and the ascent of the Kundalini that you frequently read and see is only a symbolic presentation. You find a serpent-like figure slowly moving upward. It is only a symbolic presentation of the ascent of our consciousness. Even when you listen to these Vedantic ideas, spend only 1 hour in the company of these great ideas, actually you are living in the company of a great teacher like Lord Krishna, who speaks about things other than the physical. He doesn't deny or reject the physical dimension of human life or personality. He only tells you there is something much higher to think about, to bother about. So once you feed your mind with these ideas, you find your own perspective, your own interpretation of life and world will change. That means there is an ascent. When it continues and when it is supported by active studies, contemplation and focused study and practice, then that ascent will be faster. So this is what I want to tell you again and again. The pictorial presentation of Shat Chakras and ascent of the Kundalini is correct, true, but it's only a symbolic pictorial presentation of the actual ascent of our own spiritual consciousness. This idea, okay? It's very important. Without that presentation, you won't be able to get an idea of it. These are ancient sciences. Okay.
You've been speaking about the mortal body and the death of the physical body. Is it within the Vedantic philosophy in its psychophysical system to have 7 bodies? There's references to the astral body, the causal body, the physical body, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. They belong to the empirical realm. Astral body also belongs to the empirical realm. When you take an ascent beyond the physical, when you realize your identity with the all-pervading cosmic divine reality, God's presence, when once it becomes your real experience and you become identified with it, then you transcend all these 7 dimensions of the personality. Any more? You can ask.
Good evening, Swamiji. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this Antarakarana.
Oh, yeah. Antarakarana is a Sanskrit word. Literally, it means Anta means internal, Karana means instruments. They have got 4 departments: mind, where all speculative thoughts happened one way or other, manifold thought currents, speculations happen. It is called mind. Then intellect, when the speculations come to an end, you decide about certain things, is called intellect or buddhi, mana buddhi. Chitta is a repository, mental system, let us say. That's the closest possible English translation. the mental system or chittam, the repository of all accumulated tendencies, samskaras, ideas. So for example, I can give an example. There are many things that we want to do, but what we do is only what our chittam permits us to do, really speaking. Of course, our mind, chittam, will permit us to do much of, a lot of what we want to do, but not everything. Frequently, accumulated tendencies and impressions decide how we think and what we do and what we think. By conscious efforts, by depositing more and more positive thought currents in this repository, the mental system, we can change its proportion, its function. So chittam is the third one, the repository of memories, impressions, mostly memories from this life, memories from previous life, which again become attitudes and behavior patterns, are all deposited in this system. They may not be always obvious. So subconscious and also unconscious impressions all can be seen accumulated at the lower layers of the mental system. The fourth compartment is aham, is called ego. Aham is translated sometimes as mere ego or egoity. It can lead to some misunderstanding. It is not egoism, but in the sense arrogance, self-assertiveness, not at all. It is only, well, to give an example, I shall try to give it an example, the classical example in Vedantic literature. Suppose you see an object in front of you, there is not enough light from a distance, it looks like a pillar, but you mistake it for a human form, let us say. At that time your mind is speculating, is it a pillar or a human form or something else? You come close to it and you discover that it is a pillar. Then you remember you have seen this pillar last week, because the memory is coming from your mental system. And you come to a decision, this is a pillar, buddhi functions, desiderative faculty. I have seen this pillar last week. So you remember, you identify yourself with the act of seeing the same pillar last week. That aham, the I saw this pillar last week. That feeling, that identity is deposited in the aham. So these are the four compartments which constitute antakarna or internal organs. So when we travel from life to life, your physical body you cannot of course take with you, obviously. But whatever actions you have done with your eyes, whatever you have seen with your eyes, which registers a strong impression in the mental system, that you inherit when you are born again. Your senses like eyes and ears, you do not inherit. But the subtle impressions gathered in actions involving mind and the senses of perception. Like you have with these eyes, you have seen many things in this life. That experience has registered an impression in the mental system that comes back to you when you are born again. That's why we feel a kind of deja vu, you know, we feel an unconscious feeling of a kind of familiarity. If it's something totally new, you feel a friction actually. You feel a kind of friction. When you don't feel a friction, when you feel total homeliness, a kind of inherent familiarity, that means you are already familiar with this. You have evolved a mental world, a mental system that automatically connects with these spiritual ideas. And that comes from not in this life. In some cases it could be in this life, in some cases it could be from last remote life cycles. Thank you. I think we have, okay, one more question.
I was just wondering how the Atman relates to this idea of Antarkarna then.
Yeah, okay. Now, once through spiritual practice, meditation, you experience your real identity that you are Atman, not mind or body or intellect, something far beyond all this. These are only antakaranas, which are changing. So they are not absolutely eternal. They go on changing. There is something unchanging, which is immortal. That's Atman. That's my true nature. Conviction, intellectual conviction will help, but it's only kindergarten in the spiritual evolution. Once it becomes an experience, which is ultimate goal, once it becomes an experience, then you get out of the entanglement of antakaranas. Then all the thought currents, memories, samskaras, they get dissolved. You become freed from it. So many of the obsessions, phobias, have been traced to previous life cycles by psychiatrists, both mainstream and also non-mainstream. They will not dare to make a statement in the conferences because they will lose their they won't be invited again. But many of them privately admit that many of the phobias, many of the obsessions, many of the strong feelings, which you know to be totally irrational, but you cannot get out of it, are traced to previous life cycles experiences. Okay, we'll continue the discussion in the next class. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.